Next case is 98-26-36, Sisson and Council versus Robert Ferrari.
position that did move that warrant falsely to the Court of Appeals a number of complaints. On three occasions, he accused them of not writing his opinion, having a law clerk write the opinion. On two of those occasions, he said the law clerk didn't understand. And on the third occasion, he said an attorney who had looked at it agreed. Apparently, say an attorney agreed with him that the law clerk made a value judgment based on error in a law that doesn't exist. These statements falsely accused the Court of Appeals of allowing the law clerk to write the opinion, of allowing the law clerk to write the opinion he doesn't understand, of allowing the law clerk to write an opinion apparently based in error in a law that doesn't exist. These are public comments to a TV broadcast. These are false accusations about members of the Court of Appeals. And he added that fact later that attorneys would look and agree with him on. When I asked him, he said no. He knows that the law clerks don't write the opinion. That was a joke. That was sarcasm. There was nothing funny or sarcastic about that. He also asserted in false accused that the Court of Appeals made a purely political decision. When I asked him about that, the hearing said, well, I really meant public policy. But that's not what he said. He also accused him of not reading volumes of data that was submitted. And he acknowledged he gets no personal information that anything that was submitted was not read. It was his opinion that because they didn't do something different, they must not have read stuff that was submitted. And in the last portion of that interview, tells the reporter that Avery Friedman's wife, Avery Friedman was an attorney who appeared before and represented the Birch in the matter, and Avery Friedman's wife was Judge Boggs, not the law firm, and that Avery Friedman knew something was there and was leaking stuff. He knew that wasn't true. He admitted that in the hearing. He knew that Avery Friedman's wife hadn't been Judge Boggs, not the law firm, for a number of years. Yet you hear falsely accusing the judge of being involved in some kind of conflict of interest, accusing the judge's law clerk of providing information to an attorney who was appearing before him in the matter. And at the hearing, he said, well, I meant to say she was. And it really didn't matter. That information really didn't matter. Well, why say it to a news reporter? And what difference does it make if it is or was? He's still casting his first on the court on Judge Norris. Of those six false accusations, only one appears in the quote off the record portion. I'd like to move for a second to the bank. The board has recommended 18 months stay probation. We have consistently recommended 18 months imposed. The board makes that recommendation of a state sanction because they have found that there is a connection between his interest in helping the juveniles and the justice system in Cleveland and his misconduct here.
Is that the sole reason that, I guess, that's what we have in the record, that's the sole reason for mitigating the conduct here in their recommendation of the sanction, if not that he does have an interest in the welfare of children in Cuyahoga County.
That appears to be what they stated. They talk about his blood evidence that he has a strong interest in the kids. And I don't dispute that. But our position is that interest in the kids is not connected to the misconduct. It's there, it should be taken into consideration. It's very laudable what he's done in terms of the fire safety program and the DARE program. And I don't doubt for a second that he takes strong interest in the job. But it's unrelated to these instances of misconduct. And I don't think it is mitigation that goes to the extent that the board applies.
You just would argue that it's less mitigating than the board gave credence to? Okay.
When he talks about that news chapter in his living room, he has just heard the day before of the opinion of the Court of Appeals. He is reacting to that opinion. In the opinion, they say some things about him that aren't so kind. They accuse him of thwarting the attempt for permanent adoption. They accuse him of trying to stymie the efforts of the probate court. And I think what we hear in that interview is his personal reaction to that opinion. It's not an effort to foster the interest of the kid. It's just taking false accusations and reacting to that opinion.
Not so, those are pretty strong words to do that. That's all fair commentary, I said. It's in the opinion. I think the opinion is fair commentary based on the record before the court. Those are facts that are there. What we're talking about is he's making assertions without foundation.
So you would disagree with his right to offer another view of the same record as how he did it, the language that he chose.
I am not rejecting for 1 second his right to make comment if asked about that opinion. It is what he said that I have.
So you would agree that a trial judge who's just been rapped pretty hard by the court of appeals might want to defend itself, the manner in which he chose to defend himself.
He might well want to defend himself, but exactly. It might concern that what he did was make false accusations, mischaracterize the evidence, and made statements which go way beyond proper comment.
What's the matter of
that's good point. I just spoke that's right. The matter was that he said in the interview, up for review, and so he should have been very careful about what it may be commented on in terms of the evidence. That's right. In the second incident, he's accusing the court of being in a conspiracy, and I then assert that doesn't relate to his interest in the kid. The incident in question was juvenile assault by his dad. That happened on the 10th. On the 14th, he does his own investigation. Here's why I was searching for his own investigation. He does nothing else between the 14th and the 18th when the reporter comes in and he talks to the court. A whole bunch of things are going on. At the court, at the detention center, an investigation, pre-investigation going on, one of which he instigated.
Did he offer any evidence at the hearing to substantiate his claim that there was a conspiracy to cover up the conditions of the detention center?
There was testimony provided by the respondent. None of it supported the claim that there was a conspiracy. In fact, those questions were asked of the Ombudsman, which is supposedly an independent agency, which reviews the detention center. That person said there was never any attempt to thwart us from getting information, and she wouldn't accept that there was a, quote, conspiracy. That wouldn't be how she turned it. Her testimony was that there was an incident, there were two incidents before this one, where the records were either incomplete or inaccurate. And that's what she testified. So nobody testified to a conspiracy. Either on his, on behalf of the respondent or on our side. But what I'm getting at, between the 14th and 18th, he doesn't do it. He doesn't talk to any of the administrators. He doesn't talk to any of the detention center. He has no idea what's going on. And so when the reporter comes to see him, he just makes this accusation without foundation. And as the board said, there was no foundation, there was no evidence to consider. So this bottom line position, these arguments, these statements that help to get, and that assertion that it's mitigation that should cause his sanction to be stayed. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Well, counsel, I'm interested now in touched on this. In the board's way or our way, when you're doing phase, I thought you were trying to assess sort of the whole life of, professional life of someone who's in play and what to do with things. And maybe I'm misreading what the board is doing. But I thought the study that was necessary to add mitigation rather than mitigation of penalty rather than saying they directly connect to the fire safety or directly connect to the activity that violates the rules. Am I misreading that? In response to Justice Cook's question, that your position really is
that those mitigation matters should not be weighed as heavily or shouldn't count for as much as for counting as rather than that would they somehow are guided to the attention. I would say that I agree with that they should not count as much as the aborted counting bill, but I would also say that the aborted assertion that the genesis for the underlying basis for these involving these misconduct actions, their aborted suggestion, those stem from his certainly law of concern for the kids, and I don't think so.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Coogan. Mr. Hombo.
Depends upon the degree of the language that you look at. in the Hartwell case, she was accused of, or she was found to have accused Judge Rita, I believe, in that case, of being paid off. That's criminal, and that's bribery. That's similar to the case by the U.S.
Would conspiracy to cover up misdeeds at a juvenile detention center possibly be criminal conduct? I don't know. I really don't. I'm just wondering.
Off the top of my head, I might still see a connection between that and some kind of any sort of criminal activity that could be alleged. But what he's bringing out there is that he received a memo from Johnny Williams, who was the social worker, that gave him a very, very benign sort of memo that two people had been involved in fighting and placed in separate rooms, followed up by the comments of the public information officer, who states in the article and states to the press, and this is on the 21st, which is well after the time, all I know is the supervisor was informed that a child had a bloody nose as a result of an altercation. So there are at least two people who are public information persons, social workers attached to it, who are minimizing this particular incident where the person spent 4 days in intensive care and hospital. Whether or not judge or other persons involved in the administration are also brought into that broad conspiracy, there are at least two people here that are attempting to minimize very serious incidents that have occurred. It's not to say that these remarks here and in the transcript or in the temper, they certainly are. But to the degree to which they are being attributed as being as offensive as the Baron Council would suggest, I would hope that the case is viewed, I would hope that the transcript is read, and that the assertions as to when one is on the record and off the record become much clearer upon viewing the case, upon reading the actual transcript that is real. That's not to say that a private conversation in the Hartwell case to an individual with respect to improper conduct is not sanctionable. Certainly it is. But the intent of the person, the sinister intent that is attached to this conduct by disciplinary counsel is far greater than is intended to come across in terms of the actual interview that comes across in terms of that which was actually printed in the call and code. In the articles that are written where it's accused that the administrative judge is ineffective or that he's doing something wrong, the quote is that he shows a lack of leadership. Leadership comes from the top down. Certainly the administrative judge in his administrative position must show some leadership with respect to how things are handled within the business of the court. The evidence, I believe, has shown that four significant individuals within that system have just been terminated by a substance. Whether or not that was the result of these particular incidents or not, I can't say. But the record is clear that there have been very substantial changes made in the juvenile system in Patrick County, and in part identified someone speaking out as to their effectiveness and ineffectiveness and the conduct of the person who was in a position. The case that's interesting to me that is cited by this disciplinary account is the Ryan case in California, 1988, where the assertion is made that the purpose of disciplinary proceedings is not to punish the parent judge, but to protect the patient. Disciplinary counsel asserts that in their fourth objection that the judge has not acknowledged that what he has done is wrong. He has acknowledged that, he's acknowledging that today. He has authorized me to acknowledge that these sorts of comments are inappropriate, that his outspokenness, because of his passion for this system, his passion for his court, his passion for his children, must be tempered.
Did he acknowledge that he was wrong and apologize to anyone before the disciplinary process started? You may not know.
I don't know.
Like the Judge Nara, for example. Judge Nara has reason to be highly incensed, it seems to me, with what he was accused of doing or not doing. And I just wondered if there's been a, but that's not the record, I suppose.
And I understand exactly that, how offensive that would be. But once again, I direct the court to the transcript of the actual videotape itself. The videotape itself of this incident is very disjointed, very difficult to see what preceded a brief comment that is often interrupted. It comes and goes. There's a significant period at the beginning of this tape where, are we on the record or aren't we? You can ask the question or not.
But you know what, at all times, Mr. Hollenbach, it's tough to swallow the off-the-record, on-the-record distinctions when at all times this judge was speaking to a member of the media. And you know, it wasn't, that, as we acknowledge, that this kind of conversation shouldn't be publicized in any way. And so it's difficult to really buy that as being a serious distinction, often on the record when one's talking to the media and saying things that were said here.
It goes to the issue that's raised by this learned example of intent to publicize the kind of information that would be harmful to the administrative judge, the court of appeals, and that's what I'm speaking to. There's a bitter pill learned by many people who give interviews and then are later summoned by the president in that position, probably all.
What did he hope to gain, or what was his reason why he granted the interview to begin with?
Well, the facts of the situation, and I'm not asking that particularly, but the facts of the situation point to being caught off guard. This neighbor, who was a producer with the NBC affiliate, came over and said, "Will you give an interview?" Not long later, the reporter from the station, together with the camera person, arrives at his house and he gives the interview.
Well, what did he hope to clarify by the interview?
There are a lot of confusing issues in this particular case. As pointed out, by the difference between permanent custody and legal custody. And this has been a very contentious issue for a long period of time. The testimony that there have been as many as 40 hearings or 50 days in hearings. It has been ongoing for a long time. The media had attended these various hearings. It's been up to the Court of Appeals on various written 5 times. This was a case of great public interest. The differences between the various forms of custody in place and who had what right with respect to what and what effect that had was confusing at the very least. The attorney for the virtues, Mr. Friedman, so keep in mind, during the course of the testimony said, my office was never very clear about the distinction between custody and adoption. Well, these are people that have been in 50 days of hearing to that point and didn't understand the difference between custody and adoption.
Did he hope to clarify his position on these matters? Is that why he did it?
I think that looking at the tape, as I look at the tape, and as I read the transcript from that, there is a great deal of discussion about the nuance, about the difference between permanent custody and legal custody. And those work. And we're not here to assert that its full purpose is to educate the public or to educate the people. But there was a good bit of that going on. There was a good bit of explanation about the legal system and the role of the difference between juvenile court, probate court, and the distinction between the various forms of place or custody and ultimately adoption. So I think that was the reason not to criticize the court, certainly not to criticize the Court of Appeals. Those comments, by looking at the state's recent transcript, are at the end of the interview and are intermingled with various snippets of changing the camera where there are breaks in the tape. What preceded or succeeded that is unknown. No way to really determine that. Even if you look at the tape over and over again, it's difficult to tell what questions had been asked to get the comment or whether it was just a comment. It shouldn't go unnoticed that the entire tape failed to take. Went directly to the hands of counsel in this case, who was immediately published, while NBC chose to air six lines in the 18-page transcript. In answer to your question, what was his intent? Why did he give this? Why did he make these remarks? I just know that.
You offer that to address the issue of whether or not probation or the sanction that is suggested is actually warranted in that if somebody has learned a big lesson.
Absolutely. Our position is a transgression occurred and then we have a subsequent demeanor. Now, the deposition was two weeks before the hearing, not a year before. And I would assert that at the hearing, we asked him question after question, did you say what were the circumstances, and he answered, well, we tried to minimize what he was. It wasn't a particularly political decision. I really meant it was a policy decision. Everything we asked about was not, I'm sorry I said that, or I shouldn't have said it, or it was a mistake. We never got that one. We never heard that. And that is a key factor in our recommendation. We didn't formulate our recommendation until just before explanation for the hearing. We waited until all their testimony was in. I would just simply reiterate something that was the case very quickly. The question is, does the judge who refuses to recognize his own transgression deserve the authority and manner of respect necessary to judge the transgression of others?
Thank you, Mr. Coburn. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Mark, don't be the Supreme Court.
All right. Hearing. This opens the session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio. Now stands adjourned.